Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In podcast number 67. This time around, we're doing a couple of films that are only vaguely genre. One, you could say, is science fiction of a sort. The other, a kind of fantasy come Twilight Zone-y piece. And the interesting thing about them is they both star the same actor and they're both in a new movie genre that's only about less than 10 years old called Mumblecore. The first movie we're going to do is a science fiction tale called Safety Not Guaranteed, starring Mark Duplass and Aubrey Plaza. And then we go to 2014 for a very strange movie in some ways, the one I love, starring Mark Duplass again, but with Elizabeth Moss this time around. They're both kind of low-key, low-budget movies, but very interesting in their own ways. And I want to give them a little bit of oxygen, see if we can get some people watching them. So sit back, relax. I will get the contact details out of the way, and then we can mumble about Mumblecore. The Martian Drive-In podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how's everybody doing? The weather's starting to warm up a little bit here, which is a nice change. But today I'm feeling very sanguine and very mellow and very okay with the world, because last night I went to a very, very expensive dining place for a friend's 30th wedding anniversary. A couple of friends of mine, Craig and Julia, were having a gig. Julia is, in fact, one of my Patreon subscribers to the podcast. And we went out to the Werribee Mansion, which is not too far away from where I live, which is a nice change for these kind of events. Normally I have to travel 20, 30 kilometres. But not this time. So last night, I'm going to tell you, and this is a bit of foodie porn before we get into the movie stuff, what we had for dinner last night. The amuse at the start, the amuse bouche, was a kind of, on the menu it says pumpkin brulee, but I can't eat pumpkin because I'm allergic to it. So we had a really nice little ceviche thing with some tuna, which was kind of nice. First course was fresh water trout with herb salad and a pinot gris. Second course was forest mushrooms, toasted parmesan, puccini custard and truffles with the same pinot gris. Third course was quail with garlic cream and parsley with a chardonnay. Fourth course was lamb cutlets in an olive oil emulsion with herb soil, baby vegetables, salad and potatoes with a pinot noir. And for the last course, we had a most amazing smoked cheddar, which they smoke on the premises, some camembert and some ash chèvre, which is ash-coated goat's cheese, and with the wines and the company. And then we had an anniversary cake as well. So I caught up with a lot of people that I like very much. Sal was there, of course, so we had a great time there. The food was fantastic. Saw a couple of people I hadn't seen in maybe 15, 20 years. And it wasn't an enormously large group, but it was very, very nice. And so I'm feeling mellow with the world and very relaxed and enjoying things. In fact, there were a few of my Patreon subscribers there. There was also Miss Jane amongst other people who I hadn't seen in a little while. But it was really nice to catch up with people, and it was really nice to get another chance to thank a couple of my Patreon subscribers for the podcast. And so things are going very mellowly, if mellowly, of course, is a word. But this time around for the podcast, I thought I'd try something a little bit different. And I'd seen these two movies earlier this year and thought, well, maybe I'll put them into the Martian Drive-In podcast. Maybe I won't. I'll just kind of think about it a little more. But the more I thought about it, the more I wanted to do it, because in spite of what the sad and rabid puppies say, science fiction and fantasy and genre are a broad church. And I wanted to do a couple of low-budget but intelligent science fiction slash horror, whatever, fantasy kind of movies. And the definitions kind of blur a little bit with these two films. So I decided that we are going to have Safety Not Guaranteed from 2012 and from 2014, The One I Love, which are both in a genre known colloquially as mumblecore. Now, mumblecore does require a little bit of explanation. And I've done my research and I've come up on the web with a couple of reasonable definitions of what mumblecore actually is. Now, the one I got from Wikipedia pretty much covers it. You've got to remember these genres come up every now and you get things like dogme and DIY culture and all sorts of other stuff like that. So you get all these kind of micro genres and ways of approaching filmmaking. Every decade or so, a new one comes out, if not more often. And they kind of outline a different approach to making movies. So mumblecore, according to Wikipedia, is a subgenre of independent film characterized by low budget production values and sometimes amateur actors, heavily focused on naturalistic dialogue. Filmmakers often assign this to this movement include Andrew Bajarski, Lynn Sheldon, Mark Duplass, Jay Duplass, they're both involved with the two movies we're talking about today, Aaron Katz, Joe Swanberg, and Ryan Russo Young. The term mumblegore has been used for films mixing mumblecore and horror gore. So that's basically the naturalistic. The dialogue has a naturalism to it. They're low budget. Not in this case, with the two films I'm talking about, they're not amateur actors. They're professional actors. But some of the other mumblecore movies have amateur actors in them. But this is at the top end of that particular subgenre. So, and also, oddly enough, they're both genre films in the sense of being kind of science fiction-y slash fantasy in various ways. Wikipedia goes on to say that mumblecore tells stories of the lives of characters who are usually single and in their 20s slash 30s, and frequently it's a departure from the simplistic and repetitive familiar plot structures common in larger budget movies designed for mass appeal. The films are often made on production budgets that are only a small fraction of wide-release movies, i.e. below $10 million, and some of them are shot in black and white, but not these two. The two movies I'm talking about this time, the Safety Not Guaranteed and The One I Love, their budgets were $750,000 for the second one and $1 million for the first one, which is incredibly low. That's less than the snack food budget on some big blockbusters. But nonetheless, they're interesting films. They're well done. They're satisfying emotionally. And the genre, so there you go. There's no lose there. And if you haven't seen them, and sometimes word of mouth is the best way for people to find out about this particular kind of film. If you haven't seen them, I'm going to recommend them, and I'm going to tell you why I recommend them. But first, as always, I am going to talk about the movies I've been watching since the last time I spoke at you. Now, there haven't been many of them, but they're pretty interesting for the most part. The first one is a really nice doco, which doesn't really go anywhere new and doesn't tell me anything I didn't know. It's called Magician, The Astonishing Life and Work of Orson Welles. And it's from 2014, directed by Chuck Workman. It interviews a lot of people who knew Welles. It goes through his whole life and career. It covers everything from his early days when he was with the Abbey Players in Dublin for a little while as a teenager, through the radio gigs and into his kind of long-term success, but not short-term success, with Citizen Kane, what they did to Magnificent Ambersons while he was down in South America filming a documentary, all the way through the kind of ups and downs of Welles' career and on to his death eventually. They even talked to Oya Kodar, his last partner, about his work, and that's something I hadn't seen before. So maybe there is a little bit I hadn't seen before about the life and career of Orson Welles, but his life and career are well-trod paths. Simon Callow's interviewed in the documentary, and Callow has written two volumes of a really good biography of Welles, which I highly recommend to anybody. And yeah, so if you're into Orson Welles and his oeuvre, I'd recommend Magician. As a starting point, if you're not particularly familiar with his work and his life, it's a really nice place to start. It really will give you some things to see if you haven't seen them. It's one of those movies where you sit down with a notepad while you're watching it so you can write down the names of films. It's a bit like that. I did see a kind of low-budget 1970 movie called Is There Sex After Death, directed by Buck Henry. It was just as censorship was lightening up after the repression of the 50s and early 60s. And it's silly, and at times it's sexist, and I'm not going to talk too much about it except to say that I saw it as a kind of historic document in a sense. And, yeah, it's kind of funny in parts and absurdist in parts, and yeah, I'm not going to say anything else about that. Then I decided, after what I binge-watched 5 seasons of the cartoon series Archer, the one about Sterling Archer, the inept and possibly autistic secret agent, which stars H. John Benjamin, among other people. And I was kind of binge-watching that. And they have an episode where Burt Reynolds does Burt Reynolds' voice and plays Burt Reynolds as a character. And they mentioned the first movie Burt Reynolds starred in, which is a movie called Operation CIA, which was supposed to have been filmed in Vietnam in about 1970, but it wasn't because they ended up going to Thailand to make it. Low-budget filmmaking. It's got a lot of action sequences and a few stunts that Burt Reynolds does himself. It's about a CIA agent and spies and things in Thailand in 1970, and there's lots of running around and diving into klongs and, you know, climbing around old warehouses and all that kind of stuff. Nothing spectacular, but the location makes it interesting. And apparently Burt Reynolds got enormously sick after making the movie by catching a kind of snail that reproduces in human blood, and he got an infection for that after he got back to the States and was quite unwell for a little while based on that. But yeah, it's in black and white, and it's filmed competently, but it's a really weird little actioner. Being filmed in black and white was kind of not a common thing at that time because everybody had moved to color. But nonetheless, if you want to see Operation CIA just to be a Burt Reynolds completist, go for it. It's a bit of fun. It's not boring in any way because there's a lot of running around and jumping in it. But not a fantastic action film, but an interesting one because it is at the start of that stellar career that Burt Reynolds had in the 1970s. Then Liz Travaskis and I talked about another Australian film on the ABC Local Radio Northern Territory gig, which we're doing movies that were filmed partly in the Northern Territory at the moment. So we did Walkabout, the Nicholas Rogue film from 1971, starring Jenny Agutter, Luke Rogue, and David Gulpilil. It's a story of a couple of children basically get lost in the Australian outback, and a young Aboriginal man takes them under his wing and escorts them to civilization. It's a very simplistic kind of plot pricey there. But Walkabout is beautifully filmed. The cinematography, also done by Rogue himself. He started out as a cinematographer. We didn't start out as a cinematographer. In the early 1950s, he started out as a clapper boy, but his career before he made Walkabout and performance before that was as a cinematographer, and he films the Australian outback beautifully. There's a lot of outback cover that goes from right down the bottom of South Australia all the way up to around Maningrida, where they actually picked up David Gulpilil to be the Aboriginal boy in the movie. So basically they cover everything in the centre of Australia. These kids were supposed to have walked there. But nonetheless, it's an interesting film, very beautiful is probably the best word to describe it. So we had a bit of a chat about that. Then we saw a recent movie from a few years ago, which is kind of controversial. People either love it or hate it, and it's Now You See Me, which is about a group of magicians who get together and do some heists and things. And there's another layer on it. It's trying to be a kind of magician's version of The Usual Suspects, but it isn't entirely successful with that. But it's visually interesting. It's imaginative. It's got Mark Ruffalo, Jesse Eisenberg, Isla Fisher, Woody Harrelson, a bunch of other people in it. It has Morgan Freeman walking through another Morgan Freeman role, where the character is not too much different from a lot of other characters in Morgan Freeman movies. He's just not trying these days. But, yeah, they're apparently filming a sequel to it, which I may well see. It's a bit of fun, and it's a little bit different, and I like it, but I'm not in love with it, if you know what I mean. But that's about it for the movies that I've watched. I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the chronologically first of the two movies for this week, being Safety Not Guaranteed, directed by Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World, and starring Aubrey Plaza, Mark Duplass, Jake Johnson, and Karen Soney.
Writers, does anybody have an idea for a story?
How about this time travel ad?
Guy writes a classified that reads, "Wanted, someone to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after we get back. Must bring your own weapons. Safety not guaranteed. I've only done this once before. I want to find this guy.
You know, see if maybe he believes in this stuff. I don't know. I think it could be funny.
You want to do it?
Can I get a couple of interns? Help me with
I'll
the research?
It. Me, too, please. Me.
All right, give me the lesbian and the Indian, and I got a story.
What'd you get?
Got his name, where he works. What makes you think he won't slam the door in my face, too?
Probably none of the other people were beautiful girls.
Easier, I know.
Do you sell guns here? Something sexy and affordable with killing power?
Is there a pest problem?
Well, if your ad had been written properly, I may have a better idea of what I need. I hope you worked harder on your calibrations.
My calibrations are flipping pinpoint, okay? Mm. You ever face certain death?
If it was so certain, I wouldn't be here, would I?
I think you're ready for the next steps in basic training.
I think I'm getting better than you.
But let's not get ahead of yourself here, okay? I'm certain I'm being recorded. I'm certain I'm being followed.
What's wrong with this guy?
What makes you think there's something wrong with him?
Because he thinks he can go back in time.
What are you going back for?
The mission has to do with regret, mistakes.
No matter how tempting it will be, we're never, ever going to say, hey, leave your Star Wars figurines in the box because they'll be worth like hundreds more.
So, Kenneth, why are you looking for a partner?
The world is mostly full of jank holes.
Take these creepy glasses off
and put these on you. That dude right there crushes chicks.
I believe that there are purists out there, and that's why I put that ad in the paper.
I think you're ready. I trust you.
You should. There are people following him. There are really people following him.
This is intense.
We're going 15 miles an hour.
You come to that launch site, you take my hand, and I'll show you who can't time travel.
What's your story about?
I don't know anymore, actually.
It's my hope that if you're watching this video, something incredible has happened.
Okay, so Safety Not Guaranteed is a 2012 American comedy film, it says here. Directed by Colin Trevorrow, who directed Jurassic World, and is going to direct one of the 87 planned Star Wars sequels, probably maybe at some time in the future. Probably the one about Greedo's younger life or something like that. But anyway, it stars Aubrey Plaza playing Darius Britt, a college graduate who lives at home with her father, played by Jeff Garland. There's a really nice scene between them at the start of the film, and she's an intern at Seattle Magazine. One of the magazine's writers, Jeff, played by Jake Johnson, proposes to investigate a newspaper classified ad that reads, "Wanted, somebody to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after we get back. Must bring your own weapons. Safety not guaranteed. I have only done this once before." So the story is pitched to the editor of the magazine, Bridget, played by Mary Lynn Rexgub, and they get sent off, Aubrey and Jeff, along with another intern, Arno, played by Karen Soney, who's very funny in a science fiction TV series that came out fairly recently called Other Space. So the journalist, Jake, and the two interns head out to a place called Ocean View, where they try to find out whose post office box it is that sends the classified ad in, and track down and find out what the actual story is regarding this guy's quest to find somebody to go time traveling with him. The basic concept of the movie is based on an actual classified ad that appeared in Backwoods Home magazine in 1997. And I'm reading this from IMDb. It was written as a last-minute filler by John Silveria, an employee of the magazine who was credited with the film as a time travel consultant. He has a cameo in the film. Basically, he did it because they just needed some filler for a space in the magazine, so he thought up this time travel ad, and it kind of got a little bit of interest at the time and triggered the screenwriter of the movie, Derek Connolly, to write the screenplay. The screenplay was around for a while. It was one of those screenplays that makes the blacklist and people go, hey, that's a really interesting screenplay to make a movie with. The blacklist, you should type in the blacklist into Google and find the list of scripts that are out there but haven't actually got made yet. There are some really interesting films that you'd love to see in the blacklist. But anyway, they eventually find Kenneth, played by Mark Duplass, working in a supermarket, but secretly building a time machine because he wants to go back in time, he says, and save the woman he loves from dying. That doesn't turn out to be entirely the truth. But at first, Jeff, the journalist, approaches him at his house and kind of heavy hands at Jeff's an incipient alcoholic and a bitter and twisted guy in general. And he really doesn't do it well. But then they send Darius into the supermarket. And you heard a little bit of the dialogue when she was talking about whether they sell guns here in that trailer I played. And she's just got the right tone. She's kind of cynical. If you've seen Aubrey Plaza in Parks and Recreation, she's got that kind of geek girl directness working for her, particularly in this role. And it kind of intrigues Kenneth slightly. He's a kind of goofy guy. He's got almost a mullet at the back of his head, and it's like he's kind of frozen in time at the age of 18. He's got a geek thing going. He thinks he's really good at martial arts. He practices martial arts by himself. He goes target shooting, but he's got this idea that he can make a time machine and actually travel back in time for an important mission, and he wants someone to go with him, but they've got to have their own mission. He wants to know they're serious. He goes at it like a kind of junior manager on a project. He needs to know that the person's got the skills necessary. And he and Darius, there's no real secret, they kind of have a rapport, and there's an attraction between them because they're both kind of, in an interesting way, lost geeks. They've lost their direction. Darius's mum died when she was young. And there's an interesting scene at the start when she's doing the voiceover about that, where she says, "My mum died when I was very young." And they show a scene of the child Darius standing outside the house while her dad supervises a jukebox being carried into the house. So it's obvious that after the mother's died, the dad's bought a jukebox to put into the house. So even though it is a tragic thing, yes, the death of a mum for a girl at a young age, they play it comically, and there's some nice dialogue between her and Jeff Garland, who's a fantastic comedian, in the scene. A lot of the dialogue in this movie was improvised as well. There are a number of scenes that are beautifully improvised stuff, and it works seamlessly with the script as well. The lovely thing about these two films is that some of the dialogue in both of them is improvised, but it's seamlessly integrated. It's true to the characters. It kind of really does work, and it shows one of the interesting things about well-done mumblecore, in that there is a script, there is a structure, and yet with the improvised dialogue and the kind of real naturalistic sounding dialogue, it really kind of draws the audience in a big way. It doesn't have the formality of some other kinds of screenwriting, and it increases the accessibility, basically, of the thing. Even though this is an absurd concept, kind of loner guy living out in a kind of backwoods beachside area of Washington State, who seriously thinks he can make a time machine and yet works in a supermarket. And we learn a lot more about the Kenneth character as the movie progresses, partly through one of his co-workers, partly through the investigations, of course, that the journalists do about him, and also by meeting somebody from his past. So we get a really nice character shot of Kenneth and why he is the sort of person he is. You also get that of Darius, which is kind of cool. You get it also about Arno, the kind of geeky Indian guy who's very out of place being an intern on a magazine like this. He's shy and he takes his gaming laptop with him everywhere and is awkward with the girls and things like that. And then you've got Jeff, who's a cynical 30-something journalist who sleeps around, drinks too much, and has partly angled to do this story because when he was 17 he went to this town in the summer and had an affair with a girl and he wants to hook up with her again, so they friend up on Facebook. She's the same age he is and they kind of get together, but it doesn't play out exactly the way Jeff wants to. And that's, again, that subplot, even though it's not central to the story, plays out really well. Jake Johnson's Jeff is really good in that scene. And they've also got a really nice piece of casting with Jenica Berger playing Liz, the girl from his past that Jeff hooks up with. And she has a lovely presence. And there's a really kind of cool, I don't want to misguide you at all, but it's a kind of womanliness that really works well. She's somebody who her character has a past, her character's back living in her hometown after going off and doing other things and getting married to a footballer who betrayed her. And she's kind of got, she's quite attractive and sexy, to be honest, but there's also a kind of wisdom, a kind of adult worldview that Jeff doesn't have because he's taken this job. He's kind of rejected connections and then suddenly he sees what he's missed out on and wants to go for it. But she's a lot smarter than he is about human relationships. And so there are some good scenes between those two characters as well. This is a beautifully written film, a beautifully acted film, and really nicely... The plot progresses really nicely and everybody gets their arc. It doesn't play at all like a soap opera. Mumblecore doesn't tend to lead itself to that. There's a kind of cuteness and a funniness, but there's also a wisdom about the writing in this one that I really like a lot. Then we get back to the time travel thing. There's a scene where Darius and Kenneth rob a nearby scientific research station for some lasers and other gear that he needs. And that's quite a comical bit when they're trying to escape with trolley loads of equipment and come around a corner and see that the scientists are having a birthday party for one of the other scientists. And they get spotted, but it doesn't quite play out the way it would in a lot of other films. It plays out really interestingly. And that's kind of cool too. It's a movie that subverts your expectations. Of course, eventually they find out that some government people are watching Kenneth and trying to find out what he's doing, which takes the information that the three writers have about Kenneth to a new level. Why would government spooks be watching Kenneth? And that's how the rest of the story unveils. We learn more about Kenneth. We see his plans on the wall of the garage where he's hidden the time machine. And they kind of learn that Kenneth may be just a bit more than they think he is. And that's kind of cool too. There's some nice special effects towards the end there. There's a very unusual time machine, which looks kind of cool and which I like. And the acting, particularly Mark Duplass, he's really good as Kenneth. It's one of those roles that, if played incorrectly, can alienate the audience. You don't want to play it too kind of charming, cute either, because that's not the character he is. But you don't want to play it so sort of in order to alienate the audience. So there's a balancing act there that Mark Duplass does very well in this film. And I kind of admire that kind of acting where it's not... He's not trying to play an attractive character, but he's trying to play a well-rounded one and one that you can understand why the Darius character is drawn to him. He's He's got a good sense of himself, even though it can be seen in some lights as delusional. And that's kind of cool, too. It's a lovely film from that point of view. Beautifully shot. They wanted to make it look like a Hal Ashby film. So the way the film, the cinematography of the film is kind of set up is to make it that kind of summer vacation Hal Ashby look, even though it is set in the Pacific Northwest and it doesn't necessarily take place in summer. But it has a lot going for it. The ensemble works well. The story works well. The mumblecore aesthetic of having a plot but also improvising dialogue works really well in this setting. You can see why Colin Trevorrow went on to do other things as well, because the direction is just right for this kind of stuff. It doesn't kind of take the cute and funny angle. There's a lot of it that looks very kind of documentary style. And let's see what else he's going to be doing. Colin Trevorrow is also doing the Jurassic World sequel, which is kind of cool. Let's have a look. Star Wars Episode IX, which I assume is 9. I think that one's going to be a biopic of the guy who designed the Stormtroopers uniforms and the Stormtroopers armor. So that's what I think Star Wars 9 is going to be. But just to summarize on Safety Not Guaranteed, nice, beautiful looking film, good ensemble, some really nice small bits by some comedy actors, Jeff Garland and Marilyn Raskob, and a few other people, but it really is kind of low key. It was only $750,000. I got it wrong. This one was the cheaper of the two films. This one cost $750,000 to make in 2012. And it looks like a movie that's a lot more. So it's low key. It's not spectacular. It's not over the top science fiction. It is science fiction. But it's kind of a character piece. But the science fiction is intrinsic to it, because the whole trigger of them going to look for this guy is a science fictional concept, and because it does follow through on that concept ultimately, it's very much science fiction, but it's not hard science fiction in that sense. It's kind of, in a weird way, and it's a little hard to get your head around the concept. It's a character-based science fiction piece, but it's beautifully written. I got the Blu-ray of it. I wanted to actually fork out and get this one, because I like kind of, it's a palate cleanser for me as well. I see so many of the top 10 pole science fiction movies with enormous CG budgets and marvellous spectacle to them, that it's nice to kind of cleanse your palate with something a little low-key, a little quieter, a little fun, with some interesting actors in it doing interesting things, and making a movie in a somewhat different way. It's almost harking back to the John Cassavetes thing in a sense. Cassavetes was that kind of guerrilla filmmaker, even though he was always a lot more intense in his films. It's still probably one of the progenitors of the mumblecore movement is the movies Cassavetes started making as far back as something like Too Late Blues in the early 1960s. But anyway, that's just it for that film. I like it. I don't think it's going to be my best movie of the year, but I think it's a satisfying experience, and it's definitely not a waste of your time. So I'm going to take another break now. When we get back, we're going to look at a slightly darker movie, which is actually about relationships, and that is The One I Love, starring Elizabeth Moss and, again, Mark Duplass.
I know that you know that I'll go where you go. I choose you, won't lose you. I wish you knew how much I long to hold you in my arms. This time is my time, will soon be goodbye time. Then in the starlight, hold me tight with one more little kiss, say night and night. Thank you. go where you go. I choose you, won't lose you. I wish you knew how much I long to hold you in my arms. This time is my time, will soon be good. By time, then in the starlight, hold me tight. With one more little kiss, say night and night.
That was Nat King Cole singing I Know That You Know. And thematically, it kind of works with the next film I'm going to talk about, which is the one I love. When I was watching the movie, I thought, you know, how you sometimes you watch movies and you think, okay, if I was remaking this movie or making this movie myself, rather than using the music they use in the movie, which tunes do I know that would fit thematically with this film? It's a game you can play, and it's a bit of a fun game if you know a wide range of music, which I do. And so I thought that track could actually fit in, maybe a kind of more low-key version of it than the kind of over-the-top hammering piano that Nat Cole gave. But there are some quieter and slower versions of that song, but the song thematically kind of works. So the one I love is a 2014 American romantic, it says romantic dramedy, which is an abortion of a term, directed by Charlie McDowell and starring Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss. It's almost completely a two-hander, this movie. It does have a little bit of extra with a psychologist played by Ted Danson at the start of the film, but mostly it's a two-actor film, which I suppose keeps down your catering budget somewhat. But the plot of the movie is kind of simple but kind of complex as well. I'll play the trailer and then I'll let you know what the plot is.
So since we're just kind of like dipping our toes in here, I think maybe we shouldn't spend too much time in there the first go-around.
Okay. How's a 15-minute sound?
Yeah, I think that's good. Hello?
Whoa, fascinating.
Tell me. Do you understand how insane you sound right now? It's so weird.
It's really odd.
It's like a perfect retreat. Just the two of you. I've sent a lot of couples there and they've all come back renewed.
Is it another dimension when you go through the door?
You want to go back.
This is something that we've been talking about, creating a new relationship.
I imagine like horseback riding with a little satchel of wine, you know? Not some weird version of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. We'll make up some ground rules.
Okay, no spying. We'll be honest with each other about what happens in the house.
Sophie. It's like an exercise in trust. Sophie? You kidding me?
Sophie, open the door.
Okay, Ethan.
How do you see this playing out?
I'm not leaving.
This entire weekend has been one planned trap.
Sophie, I'm stuck!
Cheers.
Cheers.
To a perfect weekend together. We also had a fantastic time when we did ecstasy, but we're not going to do that every day of our lives because you die.
Right.
Could have done without the violin on that trailer, but it gives you a little bit of an idea in the background on the movie. Basically, it's a 2014 movie. Ethan and Sophie, played by Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss, are having troubles in their marriage. Ethan's had an affair, and that's kind of alienated Sophie from him. So they go to see a therapist played by Ted Danson, who gives them some weird little therapies to do when he's in the office with them, and then suggests that they visit a retreat that he runs up in the Napa Valley. And the retreat is a house with a guest house on the back of it, a swimming pool. They can kind of go and have nice food, talk out the relationship, and maybe kind of come to an agreement. But the problem is that Sophie can't find a way in her own heart to forgive Ethan for the infidelity. even though he's trying to do what he can to make it up to her and trying to understand why he had the affair in the first place, they've just come at an impasse. They just can't keep going around in circles about it and can't really get out of that. We've all been there. I mean, I've had somewhat more than my share of relationships, and I've fucked up most of them. Some of them fucked up for me, but I fucked up more, at least my share. So I definitely understand where the characters are coming from on this. So what happens is that they go to this place. It's a beautiful house. The gardens are beautiful. This pool is beautiful. The guest house out the back is really nice. I would love the guest house they have in this movie. It was actually filmed on in a house that's owned by Ted Danson and Mary Steenburgen. And it's really, really nice. I like the setting. It's deceptive how nice the setting of this movie is. So Ethan and Sophie go to this place, and they go into the guest house, and then something interesting happens. Sophie goes into the guest house and finds Ethan sitting there, and Ethan's not wearing his glasses, and he seems to be a kind of much cooler and much more empathetic version of himself. And so they kind of talk and they make love, and then she leaves the guest house and finds that Ethan is actually sleeping in the other house and has been passed out after they smoked some dope the previous night. And as the things play out, they find out that there are alternate versions of themselves in the guest house. So when one of them goes in the guest house by themselves, the other one can't go in there once the door's shut. And there is a kind of doppelganger of their partner in that guest house, which causes some friction. The alternate Sophie is kind of more loving towards Ethan, and he's drawn to that. The alternative Ethan is a lot more sensitive and slightly more attractive looking. They're both played by the same actors, of course. And Sophie is drawn to that as well. And that's pretty much the setup for the movie. Now, I'm not going to do spoilers on the complete plot, because there are some reveals that are quite interesting. And the movie then becomes about relationships and about infidelity and about why we're attracted to somebody, then not attracted to them, what infidelity is. If you pretend to be the idealized version of yourself and sleep with your partner, is that rape or is it consensual? There's all these issues that are brought up by this weird Twilight Zone-y plot that happens in this beautiful bucolic country house and the guest house attached to it. And a lot of the dialogue is improvised. There's a lot of kind of nice little personality stuff that plays really well. Mark Duplass and Elizabeth Moss are really good at playing the alternate versions of themselves. They're subtly different, but not broadly different. It's a matter of whether he's wearing his glasses or not, and how his hair's styled slightly. And with her, it's kind of her focus on Ethan and a little bit of the hairstyle as well. So there's some really nice, subtle acting. It's a very different role for Mark Duplass than his Kenneth in Safety Not Guaranteed. Totally different kinds of characters. And he is a very underrated actor. I think because he's associated with the mumblecore movement, maybe he's not getting as much attention as he would had he been doing a lot more larger budget films that have some kind of an advertising budget. Now, this one was $1 million, and $1 million is pretty much nothing. Again, it's got all of the things of the mumblecore aesthete, that kind of improvised dialogue, low budget, naturalistic dialogue. But it does take it into a place that even Twilight Zone hasn't gone. How do they resolve this issue when Sophie is starting to fall in love with the alternative Ethan? And within a couple of days, two people have to leave the place together. Which two is it going to be? How is it going to happen? Can it happen? And that's pretty much the crux of the movie. It's it gets into some very dark and horrible places at times. Not through any overt menace, but just the menace of the situation. The encounters between the four characters and who are these other two? Sophie, the other Sophie and the other Ethan. Why are they as they are? Why is there a electronic guest book in the house saying that every other couple left happily after spending time in the house? And what is the nature of the house, the guest house, which can't be entered once one of the partners has entered? And at one stage, Ethan throws a plant pot at it, and it doesn't damage the guest house. So there are a lot of mysteries about this movie, some of which never get really resolved. Once the initial kind of supernatural / fantasy or / science fiction premise is set up, they have to work out not what's causing it and why is this happening and what kind of change to the universe causes this sort of thing to happen. It's not about that. It's about how do we survive this and how do we negotiate this and how do we stop from losing the person we love because there's a doppelganger who seems to be just a little bit smarter, a little bit cooler, a little bit sexier, and a little bit more empathetic than I am, who seems actively to be trying to seduce my partner away. So you've got those kind of issues of male insecurity, of female romanticism as well. It's a complicated movie. I've watched it twice now in the last 6 months, and each time there's that creeping dread that builds up during the film, not through kind of using boom kind of sound effects or Dutch angles or anything fancy as far as the cinematography or the direction is concerned, but just by the acting and the situation and the dialogue. Now, I'm not. It's a really hard movie for me to talk about because I don't want to take it to the place where things escalated and talk about that. But there is an escalation point, and there are encounters that occur between the characters which are quite disturbing and which, from Ethan's point of view, are very threatening as well. The aftermath of his affair has left him in an emotionally vulnerable position and given kind of emotional power to Sophie to an extent because she's got something on him which she won't let go of and which she keeps bringing up and keeps using to beat him over the head with. Whether it's justifiable or not, he's feeling in a vulnerable place. And, of course, Sophie is as well because she's been betrayed by her husband and he's had this affair and she's found out about it and she's trying to kind of work her way through the emotional mess of, you know, how do I fix this and how do I make this work and what do I do? So both of them have those vulnerabilities, each of which is cracked wide open by this really weird supernatural situation. Now, as I said earlier in the podcast, I went to a 30th anniversary party last night, and the host made a speech, the friend of mine who's been married for 30 years, and he said, if you've got a problem in a relationship, your go-to initial, he's a doctor, so his approach was, if there's a problem, you fix it, you heal it, you work out what you need to do to diagnose and treat and then resolve the issue. And it was a slightly different idea than most of the people I've ever heard talk about relationships, saying that what you do is if you've got a problem with the relationship, you work out how to heal it and you get help and you heal it if you possibly can, and that's how you can stay married for 30 years. And I found that, I mean, it's not something that I'd ever thought about in exactly those terms before, but when I watched The One I Love today after I'd been to that dinner and my friend Craig had made that speech, it kind of occurred to me that that's what Sophie and Ethan were trying to do. They were trying to heal their relationship. They were kind of, you know, in a sense, dedicated to each other to the extent that they'll go to the length of having this weekend away and trying to get things fixed. And then this weird thing with the guest house and the doppelgangers come along. And it's almost like an infection attacking the healing process in a weird kind of way. There's a kind of specific vector that comes in and infects the relationship in a totally negative way. And but the film is quite lovely. I mean, it's beautifully shot. There are some bits where two of the same person have to be in the same room at the same time, and all of the, with the beautiful digital effects we have now, that's all seamlessly done. And there's a conversation between the two Sophies that occurs, which is quite difficult because the emotional nuance that Elizabeth Moss has to show playing each of the two characters is subtly different at the start and then becomes widely different towards the end of it. So it's a really... I was kind of like, even when there was split screen stuff showing people in old movies playing twins and stuff like that, I remember Danny Kaye movie did that and other movies, there was always that interest I had in how an actor plays two very subtly different versions of the same person. Some have been more successful with it than others, but it's a really, I suppose it's one of those kind of tightrope walking exercises for an actor to be able to nuance their acting to the extent where they can play two versions of the same person. And even when they're dressed the same, the audience clearly knows which one is which. There are only a few places in the movie where you don't know which one is which. But in this film, the acting is very, very good. And the plot does take a couple of left and right-hand turns unexpectedly, which is always nice. I love being surprised by movies. Knowing how movies work is a blessing and a curse, and having a movie that kind of jumps laterally on you, and you accept the jump laterally while you didn't predict it, is kind of a joy for an experienced filmmaker. You really kind of go, oh yeah, they did that, but I don't mind because that is cool. And there's a bit of that in this film in two or three places. You've got to watch it carefully because there are some clues to what happens at the end in earlier scenes. So it's not one of these movies you can walk in and out of the room and watch. You've got to pay attention to it. It's not particularly long. How long is it, he said, asking by looking at that? 91 minutes. So it doesn't have an incredibly long runtime. But the ending is kind of satisfying and chilling at the same time. And that is kind of cool. I mean, I don't know how mumblecore is going to continue as a genre or as an approach to filmmaking. It's not even a genre in a sense. It's more a kind of working plan for making a certain kind of cinema and being able to tell stories you want to tell because you're making them cheaply, quickly, and with a limited shooting schedule as well. Of course, the slow budget demands that. But this one is a good movie. It kind of, we can all talk about it. We all know about relationships, so it's accessible a lot more than some other movies are. And we've all had trouble in relationships. If you haven't, then you're just either just out of the Benedictine monastery, or you're just not trying, or maybe you've got other impediments to it. But for the most part, people have had relationships. People have had problems in relationships, and this movie is about that, but it is about a lot more, and it uses that one science fiction / fantasy conceit to say some things about troubled relationships and about relationships in general and about trust and about fidelity and all those sorts of things, and it does it in a very, very interesting way. So that's about it for The One I Love. I did buy a copy of this one as well, so I've actually forked out for both movies in physical media. And check it out. It's worth your time. So that's about it this time around. I'm going to play the credits just after I finish. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to the Patreon subscribers. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. There'll be another Paleo Cinema next week. There'll be another Martian Drive-In podcast in 2 weeks. I've got one of the movies for the Paleo Cinema. I'm going to do Hitchcock's Notorious. And I don't know what the other one is yet, but I will figure it out. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourselves, watch good films, keep watching the skies, and I'll be back very soon with another podcast. Take care. And here are the credits for the Patreon subscribers to the podcast in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Tom the Focus Puller, Sarah the Special Effects Technician, Ian the Caterer, Grant the Technicolor Consultant, Claire the Script Doctor, Gary the Prop Master, Morris the Musical Director, Jan the Dialect Coach, Armin the Key Grip, Matt the Rattlesnake Wrangler, Elaine our Scientific Advisor, Julia our Casting Director, Chris our Camera Operator, Christopher our Gaffer, Miss Jane our Wardrobe Mistress, Tansy the Foley Artist, Alyssa our Location Scout, Mark our Second Unit Director, Paul our Special Makeup Effects Director, Tammy the Donut Wrangler, Tim the New York Unit Director, and Rabbi Steve our Spiritual Advisor. We also have Paul who does the special makeup effects, and Kathleen who has yet to have a job in the credits. So thank you to everybody who supports the podcast and to the people who listen to it. If you want to support the podcast with some micropayments, please go to patreon.com/paleocinema, and I'll catch all of you next time.